loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at several big stories. In our first story, we'll talk about John McCain's real legacy in the military-industrial complex in the United States. Then, progressive governments across Latin America have been under unprecedented pressure to move to the right, with countries from Brazil to Argentina to Ecuador either pushing liberal, progressive, and left leaders aside or changing policy to ally themselves with the United States. What's behind the move to the right? And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Lanny Davis, the attorney for President Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, is backing off statements he made last week that Cohen has information to share with investigators, indicating that Trump knew in 2016 of Russian efforts to undermine the Hillary Clinton campaign. And attorneys for accused Russian spy Maria Butina say that federal allegations that Butina traded sex for information are nonsense, and the text messages back them up. Next, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Hatami met today with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and pledged Iranian help in the reconstruction of Syria, as well as enhanced defense cooperation. The United Nations estimates that the country will need $388 billion to rebuild from a seven-year-long civil war that has seen the deaths of more than 350,000 people. Then the North Korean government reacted angrily today after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo canceled his planned visit to that country. Pompeo cited a lack of progress in bilateral talks as the reason for the decision. But North Korea said that the U.S. was hatching a criminal plot against Pyongyang and that the U.S. was not serious about negotiations. And then, in a victory for labor unions, a federal judge on Saturday struck down key provisions of a series of executive orders that would have made it easier to fire federal workers and weaken their unions. The ruling is a major setback for President Trump's policy of trying to break unions, especially those that represent federal workers. And finally, today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And in other headlines, President Trump today announced that the U.S. and Mexico had reached a breakthrough in highly contentious trade talks. The talks were part of a larger effort to revise the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. However, it now appears possible that Canada could be left out of the final arrangement, something that Trump has spoken openly about, but was contradicted by Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said today that Chinese President Xi Jinping will meet Russian President Vladimir Putin in Vladivostok next month. The talks will be held during the Eastern Economic Forum from September 11th through 13th. French President Emmanuel Macron said Europe can no longer entrust its security to the U.S. alone. He was speaking at the French Ambassador's Conference at the Elysee Palace in Paris. Seth Frotman, the top official at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau tasked with overseeing student loans, resigned in protest today. Frotman wrote to CFPB head Mike Mulvaney, quote, "Unfortunately, under your leadership, the Bureau has abandoned the very consumers it is tasked by Congress with protecting. The total value of student loans in the United States is approximately $1.5 trillion. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the death of Senator John McCain. He died on Saturday, and the testimonies about his service and character are pouring in from around the country. McCain is being described as a maverick, a dissident, a moderate who tried to wrest his party from dangerous populism. However, his real legacy is his consistent votes for and encouragement of and participation in wars of aggression, and he personally dropped bombs over civilians in Hanoi. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dr. Nazia Kazi. She is an activist and professor of anthropology at Stockton University, and she's the author of the forthcoming book, Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics. Dr. Kazi, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be on a show that is refusing to participate in the sort of historical amnesia that comes along with celebrating the legacy of John McCain.
Yeah. People in our studio and among the people outside are cheering your comment right now. I can tell you that. I can see them. You can't. You know, I'm looking at, in addition to his, you know, Wall Street Journal today, the front page above the fold is John McCain's death leaves a void. And I thought, like, wow. What kind of void is that? But here's another one from The Independent. John McCain took time out of cancer treatment, his own cancer treatment, to vote against poor Americans accessing health care. He got up out of his cancer treatment to fly all the way across the country to vote no for expanded health care coverage. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. Let's talk about the real John McCain.
Sure. I mean, one of the things we're seeing right now in sort of public discourse mourning John McCain is the legacy of this kind of conflicted, paradoxical figure with a mixed legacy. But actually, John McCain was very consistent. I mean, he was consistently pro-war. He was consistently pro-U.S. empire. He was consistently anti-woman, anti-choice, and consistently anti-environment. But you wouldn't know that by looking at the mainstream media right now. I mean, I tend to avoid it, you know, but I had to dip in a little bit to see what NPR and the New York Times were up to. And just as expected, you know, it's these laudatory pieces about a war hero, you know, the last lion of the Senate. Even, you know, one of the more recent darlings of the left, Ocasio-Cortez, has tweeted that John McCain was an example of human decency. I saw a comparison of John McCain to Aretha Franklin, you know, saying we lost two greats this week.
Oh, my God. Can you pass the gun, John? I just want to shoot myself. Oh, my God.
Aretha Franklin wanted to bail out the freedom fighter Angela Davis from prison, and he wanted to block the establishment of Martin Luther King Day. That's sort of how he got his wings in politics. So this is the historical amnesia that I'm talking about. It's just, it's sickening.
Yeah, I'm looking even at The Nation magazine, progressive, liberal, whatever that means anymore. Headline, John McCain and Russ Feingold's joint effort to restore democracy. The two very different senators established a working relationship to challenge the money power that even in the 1990s was beginning to render the Capitol dysfunctional. This is crazy. I mean, you have progressive and liberal newspapers going out of their way to rescue the legacy of John McCain. He was for, obviously, he bombed civilians. He was flying to 30,000 feet, dropping bombs on Vietnamese villages. You know, sadly, Nazia, we can't remember the names of the Vietnamese who died from John McCain's bombs. I mean, because guess what? They're dead and they lived in Vietnam and they're not rich white guys who are worth hundreds of millions of dollars who are the son of an admiral and treated like this as if he's some heroic figure. I mean, you think he was for the bombing and insisted on more bombing in Yugoslavia. I was in Iraq in 1998 in December when Clinton started the bombing of Operation Desert Fox, and they dropped 1,000 bombs and missiles on Iraq, causing a lot of death and a lot of devastation. And McCain, who criticized it for being a pinprick operation. I mean, that's the real John McCain.
Yeah, and I mean, I think actually you're right to steer this discussion toward John McCain's relationship to warfare, because this is why I think it actually makes a little bit of sense that establishment Democrats would celebrate his legacy, because that's where we see the consensus of our two parties is around, you know, support for our gargantuan military apparatus and, you know, regime change operations around the world. So when you look at the legacy of John McCain, literally September 12, 2001, he was already talking about the U.S. taking military action in Syria, Iraq, Iran, Libya. And so John McCain is part of the deeply militarized crisis we find ourselves in on a global stage. I mean, John McCain was no less than a regime change fanatic, has outright supported bombing Syria to oblivion, escalating intervention in Afghanistan, military intervention, even in places like Nigeria and Bosnia. Regime change in North Korea. People are remembering now that, you know, he kind of goofily sang to the tune of a Beach Boys song, bomb, 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 Iran. So this is John McCain. He's a person who, when protesters descended on the Capitol building to protest Henry Kissinger, he called them low-life scum and threatened to have them arrested. And this is the legacy that we're seeing right now. So in a sense, I actually think it makes sense that the Democrats would rally for him because warfare is the consensus of our two political parties.
Nazi is completely right. That's it's not really a riddle. It's not like an unexplained mystery. John McCain supports what the Democrats support. And if you look at the votes, especially over the past, even the past couple of years, sanctions on North Korea, sure. Sanctions on Iran,
yep.
Sanctions on Russia, more money for the military, they're voting the same way. They are the same people.
And that's why there was a bipartisan push to have John McCain lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda beginning Friday morning at 8 o'clock a.m. And that's exactly what's going to happen. And then he'll be buried at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. And it's because both parties demanded these honors for him.
Yeah. Nazia, in Syria and Libya, I mean, this was 2011, 2013, then 2014. John McCain was all over that, working with the organizations that clearly are armed terrorist organizations that were associated with Al-Qaeda or, in some cases, ISIS. But because they were targeting secular progressive governments that came from an anti-colonial project, Gaddafi in Libya and Assad in Syria, McCain was with the armed factions. I mean, that's who he really was, too.
Absolutely. That's right. And in that way, he's kind of part of a very long legacy of the U.S. arming unsavory characters around the world. And, you know, what we've seen is the kind of blowback that this eventually leads to inevitably. And McCain is squarely at the heart of that. You know, but one other thing I would like to bring up is also John McCain's relationship to immigrants in the U.S. I mean, as someone from Arizona, he has been squarely in favor of, for instance, the SB 1070 law, which really laid the groundwork for the immigration crisis we see today, through which scores of migrants are just criminalized. He was in support of that. John McCain has also been in support of the border wall. I mean, well, a border fence, which, to be fair, has had some level of bipartisan support. I mean, the Clintons supported the border fence, and now that's turned into the border wall. So it's quite easy to get up in arms about, you know, Donald Trump and his supporters chanting "build a wall," but John McCain and others are part of that legacy to sort of criminalize migrants and militarize our border. You know, so the same people we see today panicking about the immigration crisis are also, you know, shedding tears over John McCain, who was part of this troubling legacy.
We were talking about Peter Strzok, the top FBI agent who was fired. He raised almost $500,000 in GoFundMe. Liberals are now supporting Michael Cohen, $150,000 in GoFundMe. People who consider themselves historically progressive and liberal and anti-war and anti-racist, now, you know, lionizing John McCain. When you think about the big picture here, it sort of indicates to me that there has to be a political rethinking, a political regroupment. The traditional labels actually don't mean anything right now. The clarity about the struggle against war and empire and imperialism and racism and colonialism, that has to be reestablished as an anchoring sort of fundamental worldview and principle. Otherwise, in a way, this story isn't really about McCain. He's obvious. It's really about the trajectory of American politics.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners remember Ellen DeGeneres dancing with George W. Bush on her show, you know, and this is the sort of hashtag resistance moment that we find ourselves in that is just so bizarre and really reveals some shortcomings in our political education. I mean, after Charlottesville, for instance, last summer, I remember liberals just applauding Arnold Schwarzenegger, for tweeting out in opposition to Donald Trump's comments, saying, you know, they're good people on both sides of this. People were praising Merck pharmaceutical executives who withdrew from Trump's advisory board. And this should be really troubling for all of us, because if we can have this type of, you know, historical amnesia and just a sloppy kind of resistance in this moment, we risk, you know, kind of fighting the dangers of the Trump administration with the very things that got us here in the first place.
Absolutely correct. I mean, we have, John and I were talking about the recent poll that showed the majority of Democrats now have a favorable opinion of George W. Bush because George W. Bush is considered somewhat critical of Donald Trump. I mean, it's odd that in the era of Trump, the country in general, big politics, including Ocasio-Cortez and the Social Democrats who are running as Democrats, moving really actually dramatically to the right, at least in the questions of empire.
Absolutely. You know, this is a moment where even our intelligence agencies, the FBI and the CIA, are rendered heroes. There's something really perverse about the whole thing.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Dr. Nazia Kazi. She is an activist and a professor of anthropology at Stockton University. She's the author of the forthcoming book, I'm going to buy it, I hope you do, Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Progressive governments across Latin America have been under tremendous pressure. Previous left-wing governments have fallen. Center-left governments have fallen. Judicial and legislative coup d'etats and military coup d'etats. We're going to talk about what's happening to Latin America. We're joined from Montreal by Arnold August. He is a lecturer, journalist, and author of the book Cuba and the U.S. in the Age of Trump. And we're joined from San Francisco by Gloria Lariva. She is the director of the Cuba and Venezuela Solidarity Committee. Arnold and Gloria, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me.
Thank you for the invitation.
Arnold, let's begin with you. We saw former Argentine President Kirchner's home raided by police. The announcement by Ecuador under the government of Lenin Moreno that it's leaving, Ecuador is leaving ALBA, which was an important regional formation. We have the imprisonment of Lula in Brazil following the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, thus basically a legislative coup d'etat in Brazil. This is a rapidly and still dynamically developing pattern. It has grave consequences, of course, for progressives, but I would say for all people who are trying to overturn the centuries of poverty and unemployment and the legacy of colonialism and racism in Latin America. Just give it us, because we have a limited amount of time, a quick snapshot of what you think comes next in this process, because clearly right-wing and even counter-revolutionary trends are still unfolding.
Yeah, I think it's an important point that you're making, Brian, that what's happening in Latin America affects obviously Latin America, but it also affects the whole world because of the importance that Latin America plays in the current international situation. You say what is happening next? It's really hard to say because you listed off a lot of negative things, but we could also have some positive surprises. For example, I would point out as a positive point in the last month or two was the election of the left-wing government in Mexico. I think that's a positive point, but at the same time, you have these negative things going on, such as in Argentina and Ecuador. As far as Lula's concerned in Brazil, I see it, of course, it's very negative. It's a continuation of the coup that started against Dilma Rousseff under the Obama government in an indirect way and followed through currently. But at the same time, Lula is first in the polls, and thus, if he runs even from prison, which makes it very difficult for his party to win, but still, I think this could open up a very positive situation for Brazil, perhaps a pre-revolutionary situation where the people just will not accept the fact that the most popular leader in Brazil at the time is being kept in prison, going against even the United Nations. This could open up a positive path for Brazil. And when we talk about a positive path for Brazil, we are talking about a positive path for all of Latin America because of the obvious importance that Brazil has for that whole region.
Yeah, Gloria, go ahead. Your take.
I agree with what Arnold is saying, but I do think that the U.S. is continuing its aggression and offensive to try to overturn not only the governments and the previous presidencies, for example, of Dilma Rousseff and to imprison Lula, but they want to make sure that these leaders cannot come back again as official leaders of their government. For example, Rafael Correa in Ecuador is fighting extradition back to Ecuador because of Lenin Moreno, who is now turned to sharp to the right after his election last year. And he faces possible imprisonment if he were to be extradited. That remains to be seen. In addition, was the search a few days ago of Cristina Kirchner's homes, three of her homes that she has in Argentina. So that process is not over. We see that on August 15, the Defense Secretary Mattis traveled to Argentina, in which both the U.S. and Argentina agreed to strengthen military ties. And Mattis even said that both ways, he said, quote, are very open to a stronger military-to-military relationship and complete transparency, so there cannot be any doubt about what's going on, end quote. Which going on is this turn to the right, the U.S. fostering the opposition in countries. And not only did Ecuador leave ALBA, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, this progressive economic, social, political body of integration, but it also shut down the UNASUR office, which was the headquarters for what is called UNASAR, the Union of South American Nations. And in April, six countries left, the more right-wing governments of Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Paraguay, and Peru. They have left that body, which was an attempted economic alternative to the Mercosur. In fact, the unraveling is continuing.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And it's, you know, for all of us who are progressive, who are looking to Venezuela for the to the so-called pink tide, these were progressive moves by governments that were not based on armed struggles, not based on, quote, smashing the state and the erecting of a new state power. I think the leftist elements inside Venezuela or Ecuador or Brazil, Bolivia, Argentina, elsewhere, Nicaragua, felt that wasn't in the cards. That wasn't historically conceivable under the current circumstances of global politics, meaning mainly the absence of the Soviet Union and a socialist bloc to which these nations could affix themselves, an alternative sort of world economy. So there was an attempt to sort of legislatively improve the lives of the people, legislatively move things to the left in the case of Venezuela and other countries, maybe legislatively move in the direction of socialism. But here you have a situation, Arnold, where every opposition to a progressive or socialist government in Latin America finds more or less an organic connection to the United States, which uses economic power and its covert power, mainly through intelligence agencies, to destabilize on the question of economics and then to destabilize more in the realm of politics. It's an inescapable problem, really. And I, the reason I want to highlight it is instead of focusing on the domestic problems in any one of these countries, we need to put it into a at least a regional, but really it's a global context, because these countries' development is developing within the confines or the contours of the existing global reality.
No, that is absolutely true. I think that we have to highlight the fact that irrespective of limitations in various countries that you mentioned, the overall main problem in Latin America is U.S. interference, and that is nothing new. If we just take the recent period, it goes all the way back to 2009 with the coup d'etat against Honduras, and then you had the parliamentary coup in Paraguay, and it's continuing now. Of course, all these current governments came to power through the legislative path, legislative role, elections, and I think that, of course, they had no other choice. However, I don't think we could just describe it as being legislative or a legal form of struggle. Take the example of Venezuela. Of course, the elections were won by Chavez, and then we had the historic elections won by Maduro a short while ago, as well as the constituent assembly. At the same time, my take on Venezuela that they are, despite its drawbacks, they are successfully linking legal, legislative forms of struggle with actual people's power in the street, people imposing themselves at the grassroots level to be the protagonist, in this case, the Bolivarian Revolution. I think it's a very organic link between legislation, legality, and the struggle in the street by the working class and the other people. And, of course, linking it very closely to the wealthy in Venezuela, which is completely backed by the U.S. in that country as well as that whole area.
Gloria, go ahead. That's an interesting perspective on Arnold's part. Go ahead.
Well, you were mentioning, Brian, about that these countries can't escape the global contours, the context of what's taking place worldwide. I think that part of the difficulty that these progressive governments faced starting in 2008 was a financial crisis that began in the U.S. and spread worldwide. It has affected them, and that in part led to economic downturns. But the drop in oil prices, which was very hit hard in Venezuela and even Ecuador and other countries, even Brazil, and other raw material prices, but that happened throughout the world. And it was in the progressive countries, both individually in Latin America and collectively through the ALBA, UNASUR, and the SELAC, that they were best able to resist these economic crises. I think we need to point out that it's really the only region in the world where there was an improvement in people's economy. Politically, you see that there were 4 million people, thanks to Venezuela and Cuba, who had their eye vision restored. Some were blind and some had, you know, severe cataracts for free. That millions of homes, both in Brazil, 2 million homes, 4 million in Venezuela, have been built for the population. That poverty was reduced. So I think these leaders and these governments are popular. They were popular. And I agree very much with Arnold that the movements are still there, the popular movements. However, it's going to take, I think, a lot more resistance.
I hear you on the point that the social programs, the house building and home building, the efforts to alleviate poverty have continued. And those governments have a lot, like the government in Venezuela, has a lot more support than one would guess if you were just reading the mainstream press. But oil prices are higher today, but oil production in Venezuela is considerably off, and inflation is taking a terrible toll. So even though the government is trying to go forward, the overall economic situation can't be considered to be. I doubt if many people in Venezuela or elsewhere would think this was a good or stable situation economically. Arnold, what do you think about that?
Yes, you are right. Of course, what the media says about Venezuela, they keep on repeating, it's a basket case, there's nothing that can be done, it's hopeless, a humanitarian crisis. That, of course, is completely exaggerated and wrong. At the same time, one has to admit there are problems in Venezuela, economic problems, especially as a result of the international situation. One cannot escape that fact.
The U.S. government blames Venezuela for its economic crisis, but it's imposing even harsher and harsher sanctions as the weeks go on. That's having a very severe effect. It cannot get parts for the oil industry. It's trying mightily, but we cannot forget what the U.S. blockade is doing to Venezuela, Nicaragua, of course, to Cuba as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a form of economic warfare. We're completely out of time. We've been joined from Montreal by Arnold August. He is a lecturer, journalist, and author of the book Cuba and the U.S. in the Age of Trump. And we're joined from San Francisco by Gloria LaRiva. She is the director of the Cuba and Venezuela Solidarity Committee. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and of course that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, Brian and John, happy Monday to you. Big week again.
Yes, another big week. And we're looking at this important story that came out August 24th, but it was driven by what Senator Ron Wyden did. And everything Wyden does, John, in the Senate, if he's asking questions, he kind of already knows the answer.
Sure.
I mean, we've seen that over and over again. You know, back with the day with James Clapper when he said, hey, Director Clapper, does the United States involve itself or carry out mass surveillance of Americans? And Clapper said that what he said, the least untruthful answer, which was no, which, of course, the answer was yes, as we found out from Edward Snowden. But here's the headline, Chris. FBI surveillance devices may interfere with 9/11 calls. Those are emergency calls to the police, U.S. Senator says. And the U.S. Senator is, in fact, Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon. Let's talk about this story.
Yeah, so first, let's talk about what these surveillance devices are. They're called ISMI catchers. The brand name can be, one of them is a Stingrays, but it's certainly not a proprietary technology because you can find them online. It's not super difficult to build them. And what they do is they track a cell phone based on an identification number that the phone sends to the cell towers, you know, and that's the way that the cell tower gets your data to you or your text message or your phone calls. The problem is these devices that the FBI and other law enforcement agencies use intercept that. They pretend that they're a cell phone tower and they intercept everything that's coming into and out of your phone through these devices first, and in many cases, they then resend them through the cell phone network, so you don't even know that that's happening. 911 services on a cell phone require that there is some sort of connection, obviously, to the network, but also certain geolocation, you know, GPS information available to route it to an appropriate agency. So if these are these Stingrays are intercepting your 911 call and they're not set up to be to send appropriate GPS information, it may not connect your GPS, your 911 call at all, or it could route you to an entirely different agency that is completely outside of where you are and who you need to be talking to. You know, I appreciate that Ron Wyden, you know, brought this up to the Justice Department. I'm certainly no fan of Congress, of the Senate, but I will say that Ron Wyden has often, as Brian mentioned earlier, asked very important questions about technology and privacy. And I think that's going to be very important to see what Jeff Sessions responds in full to this query.
This is an important question, isn't it? And it's shocking to me, frankly, that Ron Wyden is the only person who has raised it. And it's not like this technology is new either. It's been around for a while. In fact, I wanted to ask you, isn't it true that it's not just phone calls that are being intercepted by these Stingray or IMSI catchers? It's even the pings showing your geolocation. So if you just happen to be driving through an area and law enforcement is using a Stingray, you're not on your phone, they still know exactly where you were and when you were there, even though they don't have a warrant to know that information.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's just due to the nature of the way cell phone service works. You know, your phone has to know what towers are nearby, and the towers have to know what phones are nearby for stuff to get sent to your phone, so whether that's a phone call, a Facebook message, or a text message, or, you know, whatever, your email, right? So having these, and these devices, again, they look like cell phone towers. Your phone doesn't know the difference. And so it's going to route information through this device. We already know, you know, we talked a while back about the Carpenter decision at the Supreme Court, right, where the court had some questions about whether or not the government could force cell phone companies to give up information about your location just based on those pings that are sent to the towers. And there was a little, you know, there, that was pushed back on. But now this, you know, this device completely gets rid of that middleman. You know, and these aren't just used in crime investigations. There has been proof that these have been used at political protests things like that as well, just to sweep up data to see who's there even. So in conjunction with other surveillance like cameras, this can be used to identify who was at or near a protest. And that near is important as well, because people will get caught up just because they might have been, you know, down the block or working nearby or their home is nearby. But people can definitely get caught up in that kind of thing without even having been, you know, participating in that sort of, you know, in a protest or other event.
I want to follow up with you on that, Chris. So we had a demonstration here at Lafayette Park, August 12th, against the Nazis and KKK people. 15,000 people came to Lafayette Park eventually. That's where it all converged. So are the police, is law enforcement using this technology to actually identify everybody who comes to a protest? Is that actually happening?
You know, Brian, I was there on August 12th. It was great to see you and all 15,000 people there. I don't know for sure. We can't say that they were using it at that event, but it has been proven that they've used it in the past. I was at the G20 protest in 2009 in Pittsburgh, and recent records had shown afterwards that they were using that event, using it there. They were using it in Baltimore during the Baltimore Rebellion after the police killing of Freddie Gray. And there have been a number of other cases where they have been using it, other cities, including Chicago and Los Angeles, that we know about. I will say, you know, on August 12th, cell phone service went down. There were so many people there, 15,000 against these Nazis, that the network completely got overwhelmed. Now, whether that, you know, or not, that was because we had this extra step of the stingray, you know, isn't clear yet. I hope that one day we will find out. And we do need to be vigilant about this kind of thing. Unfortunately, there's no way when you're on the scene to know if there's a stingray in use. And that's one of the scary things about it, because it does just appear to your phone as another cell phone tower, maybe that AT&T or Verizon is operating.
I want to say, if you don't mind, I want to skip down to a different issue. You know, we send, our listeners probably don't know, but we send articles around to each other that we would like to discuss. There's something here, Chris, that you sent around that is so important, I think, that we ought to bring it up to the top here. This is a woman who says that her iPhone was seized at the border and then imaged by the feds, again, without a warrant, because they do this kind of thing all the time. And now the feds have to delete the data. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So this woman was returning into the U.S. She landed at Newark Airport and down in New Jersey back in February. Her name is Rejane Lazoja, and she was asked when she went through the customs process to come into a separate room, and they asked her for her phone and other electronic devices. And she said that as a Muslim woman, she didn't want to give them her phone because she had photos without her hijab on, and it was uncomfortable for her for religious reasons, for anyone to see those photos except for her husband or male family members. Well, they took her phone, and they managed somehow to crack the encryption on it and crack the protection on it, and then made a copy of it. And so she, along with her lawyers from the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, have filed motions to have them delete that data. Or actually, the motion that they filed is a motion to return property. But effectively, she's asking for them to delete the data that they have. They made a copy of her phone in order to be able to try to get into it and to go through it.
And, you know, they have not accused her of a crime. She's never been accused of a crime. They provided no justification for why they took the phone. They just took it. There's been a lot of debate in the press about whether or not Americans are compelled to provide the authorities with their thumbprint or their code to open the phone. And attorneys disagree on these issues. But that's not what this issue is about. This issue is that they took the phone and they were able to open it. Isn't that something new? It seems to me that's something we should be very worried about.
We should be very worried about this. Now, according to reports, her phone was slightly older. It was an iPhone 6S, and, you know, the current generation is the 10 and the 8. So we don't know if there were security updates, and I believe there actually were the security updates that would prevent the technique they used. But we know that there are companies both in California and Israel who are working on technology to break into an iPhone and actually skip over all of that encryption and protection, right? So there's a couple related stories here that we should pay attention to as well. There's a story that appeared in The Guardian on Friday that the same thing happened in Sydney, Australia, that somebody, a British Australian citizen, landed at Sydney Airport, and the agents there demanded his phone and laptop. And the connection is important because Australia is one of the Five Eyes countries. Now, Five Eyes, that's the Australia, Canada, the UK, New Zealand, and of course the United States, is a treaty, a cooperation treaty for signals intelligence. It goes back to World War II, and effectively these five countries work extremely closely together to gather and share information that they receive. And that's why I believe that's such an important thing. I don't think these two cases are related in any way other than they've been publicized last week, but these countries are working together. You know, John, you mentioned this question about fingerprints and passcodes and what can be required of you. So back in 2014, the courts did rule that you can be compelled to give your fingerprint, right? It's something that you have, like your DNA or a hair sample. You cannot be compelled to give a password because that's not something you have. It's something you know, and that could potentially be a Fifth Amendment violation by compelling you to give that up. That has not been tested at the Supreme Court yet, but that is effectively the current law, the current status of the law.
This is something that has troubled me for some time. It's something I've tried to write on regularly, and it's because it's an area of law that's new. You know, what do we own versus what do we possess? What is a violation of our civil liberties? The courts really haven't made a final decision on this. I think it's probably going to end up having to go to the Supreme Court before we can figure out what it is that we have to turn over to the feds. Otherwise, they have complete and unfettered access literally to our entire lives.
Yeah. And also, we have to go into the question of why. I mean, law enforcement is supposed to be about maintaining order or preventing crime or catching criminals. But what we are experiencing step by step, incrementally, vis-a-vis the sort of new inroads in terms of technological prowess in the hands of the government or by laws or by practices of different law enforcement or customs agents, whereby in the name of national security, in the name of keeping us safe, there's this expansive power, you know, this surveillance state. And at a certain point, people are just basically told, you know, shut up and accept
it. Yeah, just take it.
And you're not. And by the way, it's inevitable. Nothing can be done about it. This is as inevitable, say, as the development of manufacture or late state industrial development or new high tech machinery. It just comes with the territory. But bottom line, Chris, is that the technology, yes, will continue to advance. The capacity continues to grow, and that means authority, either private corporate authority or the state, have this aggregated power that they did not enjoy in the past. But it's not inevitable. These are basically, when you get down to it, these are decisions, human decisions. These are policy choices. It's not inevitable. I think that's important as a framework because if people lock into inevitability, then they also lock into passivity, that they can't do anything about it.
That's right. There's a big push right now as well for people to just accept this or say, if you have nothing to hide, what are you worried about? Which is something we've heard for a long time, right? When privacy activists have been, bringing up multiple arguments against that. And I want to thank our friends over at the Tor Project for actually pointing out this this article that was in The Atlantic last week. The title of it is Welcome to the Age of Privacy Nihilism. And then it goes on to say, Google and Facebook are easy scapegoats, but companies have been collecting, selling, and reusing your personal data for decades. And now that the public has finally noticed, it's too late. The personal data privacy war is long over and you lost. And I just want to know which one of those companies paid this author to write that, because it is so demoralizing to post that. It's just trying to get people to give up and say that we have no control. And I completely disagree with that article. We absolutely need to continue fighting for control over our data and against mass surveillance, both by companies and by governments. And we can win this, and we have to win this.
Yeah. It's completely correct. John, I was mentioning to you a couple of weeks ago, this is sort of unrelated, but not completely, that the coalition that I help organize, the Answer Coalition, organized a big demonstration on September 15th, 2007, against the surge, the sending of another 50 or 100,000 troops to Iraq. And we were all in Lafayette Park preparing for a march to the Capitol building. And people started reporting that there were dragonflies, or what appeared to be dragonflies, overhead. And they looked like not real dragonflies. There was something mechanical about them. And the Washington Post called me a few days after the demo, and they asked me, did you hear about dragonflies? Some people are reporting that there were dragonflies sort of hovering above you, and that these dragonflies were, in fact, surveillance instruments. Now, this is 11 years ago. This is before the drone technology really became popularly known. And I was like, oh, no, that's all sorts of paranoid stuff gets talked about. Excuse my naivete, but this was 11 years ago.
Right.
And
sure,
I didn't want to be suckered by like some conspiracy theory. But then the Washington Post did their own story. And the headline was "Dragonfly or Insect Spy? Scientists at Work on Robo Bugs." And it came out October 9, 2007. And the author was Rick Weiss. And he interviews somebody who was at the protest. And she says, "I heard someone say, oh, my God, look at those." She was a college senior. "What the hell is that? They look kind of like dragonflies or little helicopters. But I mean, those are not insects." Out in the crowd, Bernard Crane saw them, too. Quote, "I'd never seen anything like it in my life," the Washington lawyer said. "They were large for dragonflies. I thought, is that mechanical or is that alive?" And then the article goes on to say, "This is just one of the questions hovering over a handful of similar sightings at political events in Washington, D.C. and New York City. Some suspect the insect-like drones are high-tech surveillance tools deployed by the Department of Homeland Security." Now, I went from being, dismissing this as a paranoid story to like, okay, if the Washington Post is actually taking it seriously. And then this is a very, very long article, which people can go back and read, October 7th, 2007. At the end of the article, and this goes back to the issue of can we do something about it, Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, who we've had on this show of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, said her group is investigating witness reports, and they filed a Freedom of Information Act request with several federal agencies. I'd like to find out, because I don't really remember what actually happened with those FOIA requests, but we need lawyers and we need activists to challenge the government at every level, whether it's through public records requests, whether it's through the exercise of our free speech, exposés about this, going on social media and calling it out, and reminding everybody the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution says that the government cannot search and seize our property. In other words, this kind of surveillance and seizure of our property, including our communications, even while we're exercising our First Amendment rights to assemble and peaceably redress grievances, like sending another 100,000 troops to Iraq, we have to fight back. We have to do all those things. And people might think, again, with the story that Chris is talking about, it's inevitable. We can't win. Well, guess what? If you don't fight, you can't win. I mean, the only possible way to change things is to try to change things. I mean, that's our message here.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Chris.
You know, Brian, I actually remember that story really well, and I would love to know if we could find out some follow-up about that and see where that FOIA request went and maybe even push it a little further if nothing came out of it. Speaking of the Fourth Amendment and speaking of winning, there is another story that I flagged here that I want to talk about, and it's reported from the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The Seventh Circuit Court handed down what they call a landmark opinion saying that the Fourth Amendment is protecting consumers in the city of Naperville against improper data collection. Now, Naperville has sort of mandated that people install these smart electronic, utility monitors, right? Instead of having the guy come out and read your meter every month or so to send you your bill, these are all connected to the public utility there. Now, because it's a public utility and it's government owned, the Fourth Amendment applies here. These meters can read not just once a month or once every couple weeks when they send the guy out, but they can read up to every 15 minutes your detailed electricity use. That information can then help identify, is somebody home? Are a lot of devices in use? Are there no devices in use? Is it just, your regular fridge running because no one's home? Or is the TV on and stuff's plugged in and stuff's running? And that's a serious privacy concern if the government, agency, which they have a public electric company there, can get into that. So this case, this is a win. And lawyers and activists from the city fought this, and they did win. So that's some great news.
Yeah, and as we do from time to time, we like to read parts of the Bill of Rights so that people actually know what they say.
And interestingly enough, when you do this on the street, most people think that it's some sort of communist or subversive text.
Oh, yeah. By the way, I can remember during the Vietnam War, soldiers were distributing the Declaration of Independence on base because it was like you could certainly circulate the Declaration of Independence, which said essentially it's right to protest. It's right to rebel against, intolerable tyrannies, whatever the framers actually had in mind about that. But those soldiers would then be disciplined. They would be brought up on charges. I'm talking about soldiers, sailors, Marines here. I mean, that happened. But here, I want to read the Fourth Amendment because, we talk about the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. Well, a lot more talk about the Second Amendment, actually. Again, something that people actually don't know what it says. But I want to read the Fourth Amendment because these are sort of inviolable rights, according to the U.S. Constitution. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Chris, that makes it clear that all of the instruments of mass surveillance, because the government is, when it carries out mass surveillance, it's searching and seizing, taking control over our persons, houses, papers, and effects. I mean, all of that is against the law.
It is. And I'm glad people are paying more attention to the Fourth Amendment. We certainly should be talking about the First and others, but the Fourth Amendment, at the time it was written, it was literally about people coming to your house, government agents coming to your home and searching you on the street. And technology has just moved so far forward that, again, it's your phone is in your pocket and they can search it without even touching you, or they can know who's in your home. And we need to be very vigilant on this. We need to assert our Fourth Amendment rights, protect them, and be in the struggle to even broaden them and make it clear that the law needs to apply equally well to electronic devices and our data as we believe it should to our physical persons.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. He talks with us about big technology issues every Monday, 4:30 to 5 p.m. Eastern time. You can listen to this show every day, Monday through Friday at 105.5 FM or 1390 AM if you're in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear it at sputniknews.com. You can also subscribe to it at iTunes, iHeartRadio, and also now at Spotify. Chris, we have about 4.5 minutes left. Let's have you take us to the next big story.
Okay, so I want to just talk about this article from the ACLU saying that the NSA continues to violate people's rights around internet privacy. They are actually taking this to court. I believe today is the hearing, and they're going to be in court over the PRISM program. We've talked about it many times, right? Without Edward Snowden, we wouldn't know about the PRISM program. This is where the NSA teams up with private companies like Microsoft and YouTube and AOL, Apple, Facebook, Google, many, many others, to get the information that you're sending over these services, your photos, anything you've stored on these services, your video logs, all your activity when you log in, log out, where you're doing that from. And so there's going to be, and again, the ACLU actually says this is a violation of Fourth Amendment rights. They say it's a backdoor into Americans' private communications, and I fully, fully agree. The case in question is about a Brooklyn man who was accused of providing material support to what they call a terrorist organization in Pakistan. But what the NSA did was they used illegally gotten information to convince him to plead guilty. They found out later, his lawyers found out later, that the NSA had illegally gotten this information and have now launched this lawsuit. And I think we all need to be watching this lawsuit. The name's man is Agron Hasbajamari, and we should be watching this lawsuit go forward through the courts after today when the first the opening statements are made.
John, the prison program, again, as Chris mentioned, began in 2007 in the wake of the passage of the Protect America Act under the Bush administration. Every act of government mass surveillance is to protect us.
Indeed.
Everything. I mean, if you look at all the bills in Congress, I mean, you can't really name the bill called the Spy on America Act
right.
of 2007. Right. So they give it a noble cause, a noble name. But, I mean, you know full well, John, based on your history in the CIA and also what happened to you, that the government, I mean, and just for our audience who might not know, John Kiriakou went to prison for 2.5 years because he revealed that the Bush administration was engaged in torture. Torture, too, was carried out for a noble cause. I mean, it's always for a noble cause.
Always. You know, I would really, really encourage listeners also to Google this PRISM program. It's so dangerous. It's such an affront to our civil liberties and to our civil rights. And most Americans know little or nothing about it. So educate yourselves. Take a look at it. Read the original bill. It'll make your hair stand up. This is something that is anti-democratic, undemocratic, something we should be fighting against.
All right. We have 90 seconds left. Chris Garafa. Every week we end this segment with a tech tip. I tried one or two of your tech tips, especially changing my passwords, and I completely confused myself. I can't get into any of my accounts now, but that's just amateurism. It doesn't mean it wasn't a good tip. What's your tech tip for today?
All right, Brian. My tech tip for today is to call up your cell phone provider and set up an account PIN. Now, this is different than the password you use to log in and pay your bill. An account PIN, it's a 4-to-6-digit code that you have to provide before you can make any changes to your account, like getting a new phone, changing your plan. The reason this is so important is that it's actually easy for somebody to walk into a cell phone store with some information about you, maybe even a fake ID, although not even all the time that's necessary, and say they're you and take over your phone number. And this has happened to celebrities. This has happened to just regular people. And through that, they can get into any service that has your phone number. You can reset your Instagram password, for example, your email password, if you've given it to them. If people haven't done that, they should go online and they should or call their provider and go and set up that PIN. If you have done that, unfortunately, there was a leak of PINs from AT&T and T-Mobile recently, so you should go into your account and reset that. This is a complicated topic. I'm hoping to be writing some more about this, but go in, call your cell phone company, set up a PIN, or go reset it if you already had one.
All right. That was the voice of Chris Garafa. Chris talks to us every Monday in our segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.